How did you get into the house? Your mother let me in. Did she now? What do you want? Can I come in?
No.
You spoke to Daisy?
Yes, I did. Are you really going to marry that cow?
I understand you're angry, Thursday. I didn't want you to find out this way. I was going to tell you myself, but you kind of dashed off the last time we were together.
There was an awkward silence. I stared at the taps.
I'm getting on, said Landon finally. I'll be 41 next June, and I want a family.
And Daisy will give you that?
Sure. She's a great girl, Thursday. She's not you, of course, but she's a great girl. Very...
dependable?
Solid, perhaps. Not exciting, but reliable.
Do you love her?
Of course.
Then there seems little to talk about. What do you want from me?
Landon hesitated. I just wanted to know that I was making the right decision.
You said you loved her.
I do.
And she will give you the children you want?
That too.
Then I think you should marry her.
Landon hesitated slightly. So that's okay with you?
You don't need my permission.
That's not what I meant. I just wanted to ask if you think this could all have had some other outcome. I placed a flannel over my face and groaned silently. It wasn't something I wanted to deal with right now.
No, Landon, you must marry her. You promised her. And besides, I thought quickly, I have a job in Ohio.
Ohio?
As a literatech. One of my colleagues at work offered it to me.
Who?
A guy named Cable. Great fellow he is, too.
Landon gave up, sighed, thanked me, and promised to send me an invitation. He left the house quietly. When I came downstairs 10 minutes later, my mother was still wearing a forlorn, I wish he were my son-in-law sort of look.
Chapter 24. Martin Chuzzlewit is reprieved. My chief interest in all the work that I have conducted over the past 40 or so years has been concerned with the elasticity of bodies. One tends to think only of substances such as rubber in this category, but almost everything one can think of can be bent and stretched. I include, of course, space, time, distance, and reality. Professor Mycroft next.
Crofty! Polly!
They met at the shores of the lake, next to the swathe of daffodils that rocked gently in the warm breeze. The sun shone brightly, throwing a dappled light upon the grassy bank on which they found themselves. All about them, the heavy scent of summer lay upon the land, bringing with it a feeling of calm and serenity that hushed the senses and relaxed the soul. A little way down the water's edge, an old man in a black cape was seated upon a stone, idly throwing pebbles into the crystal water. It might have been almost perfect, in fact, apart from the presence of Felix VIII, his face not yet healed, standing on the daffodils and keeping a careful eye on his charges. Worried about Mycroft's commitment to his plan, Acheron had allowed him back into I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud to see his wife.
"Have you been well, my love?" asked Mycroft.
She pointed surreptitiously in the direction of the caped figure.
"I've been fine, although Mr. W. over there seems to think that he's God's gift to women. He invited me to join him in a few unpublished works, a few flowery phrases, and he thinks I'm his."
"The cad!" exclaimed Mycroft, getting up. "I think I might just punch him on the nose."
Polly pulled his sleeve and made him sit down. She was flushed and excited at the idea of her septuagenarian husband and Wordsworth getting into a fight over her. It would have been quite a boast at the Women's Federation meeting.
"Well, really," said Mycroft. "These poets are terrible philanderers."
He paused.
"You said no, of course."
"Well, yes, naturally."
She looked at Mycroft with her sweetest smile, but he had moved on.
"Don't leave daffodils, otherwise I won't know where to find you."
He held her hand, and together they looked out across the lake. There was no opposite shore, and the pebbles that Wordsworth flicked into the water popped back out after a moment or two and landed back on the foreshore. Aside from that, the countryside was indistinguishable from reality.
"I did something a bit silly," announced Mycroft quite suddenly, looking down and smoothing the soft grass with his palm.
"How silly?" asked Polly, mindful of the precariousness of the situation.
"I burned the Chuzzlewit manuscript."
"You did what?"
"I said, I heard. Such an original manuscript is almost beyond value. Whatever made you do a thing like that?"
Mycroft sighed. It was not an action he had taken upon himself lightly.
"Without the original manuscript," he explained, "major disruption of the work is impossible. I told you that maniac removed Mr. Quaverley and had him killed. I didn't think he'd stop there. Who would be next? Mrs. Gamp? Pecksniff? Martin Chuzzlewit himself? I rather think I might have been doing the world a favour."
"And destroying the manuscript stops this, does it?"
"Of course. No original manuscript, no mass disruption."
She held his hand tightly as a shadow fell across them both.
"Time's up," said Felix Eight.
I had been right and wrong over my predictions regarding Acheron's actions. As Mycroft told me later, Hades had been furious when he discovered that no one had taken him seriously, but Mycroft's action in destroying Chuzzlewit simply made him laugh. For a man unused to being hoodwinked, he enjoyed the experience. Instead of tearing him limb from limb, as Mycroft had suspected, he merely shook him by the hand.
"Congratulations, Mr. Next," he smiled. "Your act was brave and ingenious. Brave, ingenious, but sadly self-defeating. I didn't choose Chuzzlewit by chance, you know."
"No,"
retorted Mycroft.
"No. I was made to study the book at O-level, and really got to hate the smug little shit. All that moralizing and endless harking on about the theme of selfishness. I find Chuzzlewit only marginally less tedious than our mutual friend. Even if they had paid the ransom, I would have killed him anyway, and enjoyed the experience tremendously."
He stopped talking, smiled at Mycroft, and continued.
"Your intervention has allowed Martin Chuzzlewit to continue his adventures. Todger's boarding house will not be torched, and they can continue their unamusing little lives unperturbed."
"I am glad of that," replied Mycroft.
"Save your sentiments, Mr. Next. I haven't finished. In view of your actions, I will have to find an alternative. A book which, unlike Chuzzlewit, has genuine literary merits."
"Not Great Expectations."
Acheron looked at him sadly.
"We are beyond Dickens now, Mr. Next. I would have liked to have gone into Hamlet and throttled that insufferably gloomy Dane, or even skipped into Romeo and Juliet and snuffed out that little twerp Romeo."
He sighed before continuing.
Sadly, none of the bard's original manuscripts survive."
He thought for a moment.
"Perhaps the Bennet family could do with some thinning."
"Pride and Prejudice!" yelled Mycroft. "You heartless monster!"
"Flattery will not help you now, Mycroft. Pride and Prejudice without Elizabeth or Darcy would be a trifle lame, don't you think? But perhaps not Austen. Why not Trollope? A well-placed nail bomb in Barchester might be an amusing distraction. I'm sure the loss of Mr. Crawley would cause a few feathers to fly. So, you see, my dear Mycroft, saving Mr. Chuzzlewit might have been a very foolish act indeed."
He smiled again and spoke to Felix Eight.
"My friend, why don't you make some inquiries and find out the extent of original manuscripts and their whereabouts?"
Felix Eight looked at Acheron coldly.
"I'm not a clerk, sir. I think Mr. Hobbs would be eminently more suitable for that task."
Acheron frowned.
Of all the Felixes, only Felix III had ever contradicted a direct order. The hapless Felix III was liquidated following a very disappointing performance when he hesitated during a robbery. It had been Acheron's own fault, of course. He had tried to endow Felix III with slightly more personality at the expense of allowing him a pinch of morality. Ever since then, he had given up on the Felixes as anything but loyal servants. Hobbs and Dr. Müller had to be his company these days.
"Hobbs!"
shouted Hades at the top of his voice. The unemployed actor scuttled in from the direction of the kitchens, holding a large wooden spoon.
"Yes, sire."
Acheron repeated the order to Hobbs, who bowed and withdrew.
"Felix VIII?"
"Sir?"
"If it's not too much trouble, lock Mycroft in his room. I dare say we will have no need of him for a couple of weeks. Give him no water for 2 days, and no food for 5. That should be punishment enough for disposing of the manuscript."
Felix VIII nodded, and removed Mycroft from the hotel's old lounge. He took him out into the lobby, and up the broad marble staircase. They were the only ones in the mouldering hotel. The large front door was locked and bolted. Mycroft stopped by the window, and looked out. He had once visited the Welsh capital as a guest of the Republic to give a talk on synthesizing oil from coal. He had been put up in this very hotel, met anyone who was anyone, and even had a rare audience with the highly revered Brodyr Ulyanov, octogenarian father of the modern Welsh Republic. It would have been nearly 30 years ago, and the low-lying city had not changed much. The signs of heavy industry still dominated the landscape, and the odour of ironworks hung in the air. Although many of the mines had closed in recent years, the winding gears had not been removed. They punctuated the landscape like sentinels, rising darkly above the squat slate-roofed houses. Above the city on Morlaith Hill, the massive limestone statue of John Frost looked down upon the republic he had founded. There had been talk of moving the capital away from the industrialized south, but Merthyr was as much a spiritual centre as anything else. They walked on, and presently came to Mycroft's cell, a windowless room with only the barest furniture. As he was locked in and left alone, Mycroft's thoughts turned to that which troubled him most, Polly. He had always thought she was a bit of a flirt, but nothing more, and Mr. Wordsworth's continued interest in her caused him no small amount of jealous anxiety.
Chapter 25. Time Enough for Contemplation. I hadn't thought that Chuzzlewit was a popular book, but I was wrong. Not one of us expected the public outcry and media attention that his murder provoked. Mr. Quaverley's autopsy was a matter of public record. His burial was attended by 150,000 Dickens fans from around the globe. Braxton Hicks told us to say nothing about the Literatech involvement, but news soon leaked out. Bowden Cable, speaking to the Owl newspaper. Commander Braxton Hicks threw the newspaper on the desk in front of us. He paced around for a bit before collapsing heavily into his chair.
"I want to know who told the press," he announced.
Jack Shit was leaning on the window frame and watching us all while smoking a rather small and foul-smelling Turkish cigarette. The headline was unequivocal.
"Chuzzlewit death. Spec ops blamed."
It went on to outline specifically how unnamed sources within Swindon Spec Ops had intimated that a botched ransom payment had been the cause of Quaverley's death. It was us about face, but the basic facts were correct. It had placed Hicks under a lot of pressure and caused him to overspend his precious budget by a phenomenal amount to try to discover Hades' whereabouts. The spotter plane that Bowden and I had pursued had been found a burnt-out wreck in a field on the English side of Hay-on-Wye. The Gladstone full of the counterfeit money was close by, along with the ersatz Gainsborough. It hadn't fooled Acheron for 1 second. We were all convinced that Hades was in Wales, but even political intervention at the highest level had drawn a blank. The Welsh Home Secretary himself had sworn that they would not knowingly stoop to harbour such a notorious criminal. With no jurisdiction on the Welsh side of the border, our searches had centred around the marshes, to no avail.
"If the press found out, it wasn't from us," said Victor.
We have nothing to gain from press coverage and everything to lose.
He glanced over at Jack Shit, who shrugged.